From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump and Prime Minister Theresa May of Great Britain emphasized a close relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. during their press conference today, despite the interview President Trump did with the Sun newspaper yesterday in which the president criticized May's Brexit strategy. Here's a clip from that interview.
I did give her my views on what she should do and how she should negotiate. Mm-hmm. And she didn't follow those views. I would actually say she probably went the opposite way. Mm. If you really look, she probably went the opposite way. And that's fine. You know, she should negotiate the best way she knows how. But it's too bad.
Joining us now from some of the protests over President Trump's visit in central London is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. Hi, Rob.
Hi there, Jeremy.
Let's listen here to President Trump today. This is what he said about his Sun interview.
No, I said very good things about her. I didn't think they put it in, but that's all right. They didn't put it in the headline. I wish they put that in the headline. That's one of those things. And she's a total professional, because when I saw her this morning, I said, I want to apologize because I said such good things about you. She said, don't worry, it's only the press.
Is it only the press, Rob? I mean, what did you make of President Trump kind of backing off what he said?
Well, I think it's a bit like trying to, you've chucked a hand grenade, you've taken the pin out, the explosion has gone off, everything's lying in pieces, and then you try and put the pin back in. I guess that's the best way I could describe it. But I mean, here's the odd thing. The initial chucking of the hand grenade, in other words, the interview that he gave, which was, I think it's hard to think of a moment where a U.S. president has said something more humiliating about a prime minister than the contents of that interview. So not only did you have the damage done by that, but strangely enough, I mean, when he then later said at the news conference at Chequers, well, you know, she's a very special person. I really like her. She's fantastic. She's incredible. I mean, given how unpopular Donald Trump is here in the UK, it's neither very good to be criticized by him nor praised either.
Mm. Let's listen to Prime Minister May's response when journalists asked her about what she thought of that Sun interview.
No, look, I'm very clear that our Brexit plan will deliver on what the British people voted for. And we've had an excellent discussion here, as I've said about, and as President Trump has said, about the possibility and the intent that we both have to have an ambitious trade deal going forward.
Did Theresa May miss an opportunity there to stand up to President Trump right in person?
Well, she did slightly have the appearance of someone who'd swallowed a stinging insect. I mean, it hasn't exactly been the easiest couple of days for her. I mean, I think some people will think that she very much did, and I'm not sure how many listeners will remember that rather sort of soppy romantic English film, Love Actually, where a prime minister played by Hugh Grant stands up to the American president. And everybody cheers, and suddenly, going from being very unpopular to very popular, well, Theresa May doesn't do that. I mean, as you could hear from her response, she's often referred to as the Maybot for sticking robotically to a line, and she just decided, as you guys in the US would say, to sort of suck it up, or as we here in the UK would say, to take it on the chin. But I think people will say that she's missed an opportunity, and I think just briefly on a slightly more serious point, I mean, the fact that she decided to suck it up, take it on the chin, is a reflection of something that critics worried about with Brexit, that it would force the UK to pivot away from Brussels to Washington, meaning that the UK would be much more beholden to the US than it ever has been before, which would become more difficult, depending, of course, on who was the White House.
One more thing, Rob. People can hear behind you protests going on. You're joining us from Trafalgar Square in central London. What's going on there at the moment?
Well, it's just an enormous protest against the U.S. president. I mean, I think the latest opinion polls suggest that something like 4 out of 5 Brits have a pretty unfavorable opinion of Donald Trump. I mean, I don't think any U.S. leader has got ratings as low as that, not even Nixon or George Bush at the height of the Iraq War. So Donald Trump, I don't think he'd do very well if he stood for election in this country. There is a lot of strong feeling out there, and whether it's on Donald Trump's attitude to immigration, to women, you name it, you know, there are plenty of people in the UK who are prepared to take the streets to protest about it. And of course, this, interestingly, is one of the first big demonstrations against Donald Trump in Europe. In other countries, it doesn't seem to have been quite so toxic. Maybe that's actually a a sort of a byproduct of the fact that the relations between our countries are so close, and that people think, hang on a minute, why are we sucking up to this president?
Any numbers right now on how many people are out?
I don't know, but I think they're expecting, you know, 100,000 or more, Jeremy.
It's BBC's Rob Watson joining us from London. Rob, thank you.
Good to be with you as always, Jeremy.
Well, let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, so we have a president blasting allies in public, demanding they increase spending to 4%, then claiming victory even though they didn't. Blasting America's special friend, the leader of Britain, Theresa May, is said to be softening the exit from the EU. Trump wants a harder break. He says she didn't listen to him. Sounds a little mansplaining there, but then says he didn't say that, knowing it's recorded. We heard it. Is there an historical comparison?
This is one of those cases where it's hard to think of anything like this. There's obviously been tensions between the U.S. and NATO partners. We can even remember with President George W. Bush, the tension with many of our allies over Iraq. But nothing like this, nothing like the open hostility the president has had toward allies, this interview where he cuts against the British leader on her own grounds, and then this back and forth over what he said. This is really a remarkable moment where you see the strain on this historic alliance from the post-World War II period.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Remind us what the post-World War II new order was. And do you think that Trump has dismantled it?
Well, it comes out of devastated Europe in World War II after tens and millions of people have died, and many European countries are struggling to rebuild themselves. And at the same time, the Soviet Union is strengthening and expanding itself and trying to gain more territorial control. And NATO is an alliance of allies meant to enter into a pact and work together to protect each other. And it was a really important moment in 1949 where this alliance was formed. And it's unclear if Trump will be able to break it, because there's many interests all the allies have in maintaining this beyond the current U.S. president. But that said, these kinds of moments like we're having in the last few weeks really strain the relationship. It is a relationship. It's not just about paying dues. And so this has an effect.
Well, and, you know, I've been hearing from some listeners saying, well, wait a second. You know, we've had bellicose leaders before. And we were hearing this week from FDR, a new book's out, and that Madison Square Garden speech in 1938 when he's talking about Wall Street. And he says, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. You know, but it feels like it's different to rail against fat cats than it is to rail against, you know, pitiful immigrants, for instance, detained crossing the border.
Well, yes. I mean, all of this is true. And so we have had presidents rail against many adversaries. I think the difference that some feel with this president is it's unscripted, uncontrolled, unpredictable in a way that those other presidents were not. They still were working with a set of advisors and working with Congress less in an ad hoc manner than we see with the current president. And then you have a whole set of policies like the separation of children from their families, which is a whole other set of issues. But it all comes down to his style of leadership and what I think many see as a reckless approach to governing, which makes the bellicosity different than what we've seen from other presidents.
Will it not matter to historians? Will none of this matter, the dissembling, the, you know, not telling the truth, the tone? Will it not matter if, in fact, you know, America continues with a great economy and there are no wars on his watch? I mean, what will make it matter to historians?
Well, it will matter. I do think that's a good warning. We have to see what the outcome of the presidency is to see how people evaluate the different components. But the part you're talking about, playing with the truth and saying things that are not true constantly on an ongoing basis and basically devaluing the notion of objectivity and facts in American politics, I do think that is what historians will write about as a important part of what this president did and the way he shaped our public culture.
Julian, we only have a minute left here, but I'm, you know, staying with Europe, I wonder what you are hearing in the president's language about immigration in that interview with The Sun that he did. He talked about Europe losing its culture because of immigration. Now, European countries have been more homogenous than the U.S., which is a nation of immigrants. But are you hearing a whiff of something historical?
It's the same kind of nativist rhetoric that he often uses here in the United States. It's about what he says is a culture in peril, and it's about a threat that he is arguing immigrants make to some kind of authentic culture. And this is an old language in American politics and one that's usually tied to restrictionism and anti-immigrant policies.
I just wonder if it has a stronger whiff given the, you know, the continent. You know, those are the same things said about Jews.
Well, there's a long history of this rhetoric, and it's been used in very ugly ways. And that's why he needs to be incredibly cautious in what he evokes.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, co-author of the new book, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
A blockbuster indictment today from the Justice Department and Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of possible Trump campaign collusion with Russia. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced charges against 12 Russian intelligence officers, accusing them of hacking the computer networks of the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and the presidential campaign of Hillary Clinton. Rosenstein said the Russian officers also tried to hack U.S. election systems.
One of those defendants and a 12th Russian military officer are charged with conspiring to infiltrate computers of organizations involved in administering elections, including state boards of election, secretaries of state, and companies that supply software used to administer elections.
The news comes just days ahead of President Trump's visit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Joining us now is Ryan Lucas, who covers the Justice Department for NPR. Ryan, just start with more about what this indictment says.
Well, first off, there are three actual charges here. You have identity theft, money laundering, and conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States. More broadly, what this indictment says is it really basically gives us a sort of detailed look at how Russian military intelligence officers hacked into U.S. computers during the 2016 campaign, that they covertly monitored computers from dozens of Democratic National Committee and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee employees, that they implanted files with malicious code, stuff known as malware, to monitor what these employees were doing, to steal keystrokes, to steal passwords, and this allowed them to steal emails, to take screenshots, to steal other documents, and they used false identities and cryptocurrency to help pay for all of this. They began planning the release of what they had stolen in April of 2016 and actually began releasing it in June. They used fictitious online personas, two that we're very familiar with, of course. That's Guccifer 2.0 and DC Leaks. And they also released them through an organization that is unnamed in the indictment. But that organization, of course, we know to be WikiLeaks.
And not in this indictment is any claim that Americans were involved in the hacking or that the election results were affected. Is that right?
It is. It's what Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said was that there was no indication that any Americans knowingly took part in this, which is different from saying that there weren't any Americans who were in some way, shape or form kind of used by the Russians. Now, as far as the election results not being affected, this is something that we've heard time and again from U.S. officials that there's no way of saying whether indeed what the Russians did had an impact on the final vote tally. But the fact that the Russians were interfering in the election is undisputed at this point by, well, the Justice Department and certainly U.S. intelligence agencies.
I just want to read a little bit from this indictment. It says the conspirators spearfished individuals affiliated with the Clinton campaign throughout the summer of 2016. For example, on or about July 27th, 2016, the conspirators attempted after hours to spearfish for the first time email accounts at a domain hosted by a third party provider and used by Clinton's personal office. Now, that July 27th, 2016 was the very same day that President Trump Trump said, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. You know, we don't know if that's what caused people to do what this indictment says and start spearfishing these places. But it's interesting that that date is in there.
It is. I mean, there are a lot of there's going to be a lot of overlap from what we've heard and what people have speculated about. And now what this indictment does is kind of provide a structure and new details for us to go back through and look at history and timeline and see what conclusions we can draw. Of course, a lot of it is going to remain speculation. Special Counsel Robert Mueller knows a lot more about this. And what this indictment does is spell out just how much detail and depth he's able to give as to the events that we know kind of bare bones about over the course of 2016.
When are we going to know as much as Mueller knows? Because this has been going on now for a long time. This is 12 more Russians being indicted. There were 13 Russians a few months ago. Four former Trump campaign and White House aides, three have pleaded guilty. When's this going to come to a conclusion?
Well, that's hard to say. Only Special Counsel Robert Mueller knows. But his investigation is moving, if you look at it historically, at a very quick pace. He has returned, as you said, a number of indictments. As for when we'll get an answer to the question of, you know, what were there indeed was there coordination between Russians and the Trump campaign? I don't know. It's really hard to say, and that's something that only Mueller's going to be able to tell us, and that may take months.
It's Ryan Lucas, who covers the Justice Department for NPR. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Justice Department also announced this week that it's reopening its investigation into the death of Emmett Till after a book revealed that the white woman who said a then 14-year-old black teen, Till, accosted her, told the author, Timothy Tyson, she lied. Till was murdered in 1955. His murder helped spark the civil rights movement, and now people are relitigating it on social media. Let's see how this and other stories are trending with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. So two men had been accused and cleared in the death and acquitted in the death of Emmett Till. They later confessed to murdering him in a magazine article, but now both are dead. What are you seeing people saying about this, reopening this incredible case? What are they saying on social media?
I'll give you a little snippet of a conversation because this is quite representative of how people are having this conversation online and offline, of course, as well. Paul Brooks tweets, with all due respect to young Till, I wish I could understand the point of this. Progress, strides toward race relations. Truthfully, all I see is a glorified stage show. Then Allison jumps right in off the back of that point and says, justice. Justice is the point. But a lot of people online are saying, but why is this relevant? This was 1955. And let me leave you with this quote for this particular story before I move on. I'm Just Shala says, and she quotes Emmett Till's mother back in 1955, what happens to any of us anywhere in the world had better be the business of all of us. And then she says in her tweet, it's ridiculous that 63 years later, we are still living in times like these. People are still being killed senselessly and no justice is being served. Mm-hmm. Hashtag Emmett Till brings us right back up to date.
Well, for many, it's just a throwback. This woman, Carolyn Dunham, told the author, nothing that boy, as she put it, did could ever justify what happened to him. How do you live with that for decades?
Exactly.
You lied. So there's that story and sounds like a great book. We note that. But moving on to Twitter itself, people may have noticed that they lost some followers this week. Some of us can't afford that. But the company says it's...
Well, they may not have noticed if they had that many.
Right. Well, they've been removing tens of millions of bots, spammers, locked accounts from the platform. What effect is it having?
Well, it's called the hashtag Twitter Purge, and I'm just looking to see how people's popularity has actually been dented and changed by the number of followers. So how do you know if you've been Twitter purged? Well, there's an analytics site. You can go to this right now, socialblade.com. Type in the social media account you want to look at, and it will tell you how many followers it has, how many it has lost, and how it is doing in real time. So on Thursday, I hate to break this to you here and now, you lost 217 followers. Gone. Absolutely gone. But it could be worse. President Trump on Thursday lost 326,000. And the former President Obama on Friday morning lost 1.6 million followers.
Okay.
But the more followers you have, the more likely you are to lose them. This is all part of Twitter's plan to clean up Twitter so you don't have bots and locked accounts following you. You only have real live people who tweet.
And this is after the New York Times found that there's, you know, one small Florida company, for instance, that's selling millions of fake followers. So there's that. We have to touch on Serena Williams, who love to, you know, just touch her. It would maybe let me play tennis. She is just getting so much love as she heads to Wimbledon playing tomorrow. Could be her eighth Wimbledon title.
Amazing.
Her biggest supporter on Twitter, clearly her husband, Alexis.
It's his job.
Oh, yeah, Ohanian. But what else are people saying?
Alexis Ohanian tweeted out just one word with Serena Williams getting through to the finals. Believe. The Economic Times has this. Serena Williams demonstrated that having a baby had not robbed her of any of her phenomenal tennis skills, which she became the first mother in 38 years to reach the Wimbledon. And then there's a little emoji of a strawberry. And many more fans are just tweeting out goats emoji. Greatest of all time.
Of all time. Okay.
Yes.
There's that. We got to touch on this story of a couple. They met on a plane during a flight from New York to Dallas last week. And the person in the seat behind them apparently documented some of that and was tweeting it out. Some people say it's a fairy tale. I think it's really creepy that somebody was documenting what was happening in the row in front of them.
Well, it was romantic and fun until then you realised it was creepy. It all started on a plane with Rosie Blair. She's an actress. She was flying with her boyfriend, but they weren't seating together. And this was the very first tweet. My boyfriend and I asked a woman to switch seats with me so we could sit together. We made a joke that maybe her seat partner would be the love of her life. And then they both tweeted and photographed and imagined this entire romantic story and chemistry. They got closer. Mm. They went to the restroom. They followed them to baggage claim. They identified them. And a lot of people on Twitter and online and offline, in terms of ethics, are saying this is unethical. Right. These two people were in a Twitter thread without their knowledge. Plane Bay, the guy, loved it. Plane Babess did not, and she would rather not have the publicity. So I think it's a lesson to us all to be careful about tweeting strangers' loves.
Yeah.
Because they're not just content for us online.
Right. Really? We're not going to name them either. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks.
AT&T's merger with Time Warner is facing a new legal hurdle. The $85 billion deal was finalized last month after a judge rejected a challenge from the Justice Department. But yesterday, the Justice Department filed a notice that it will appeal the judge's ruling. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, tell us more about this appeal. We talked just a few days ago about how AT&T's chief was telling HBO, which would now be under AT&T's control, that things are going to change. And everybody at HBO was like, oh, my gosh, things are going to have to be done totally differently. And now this holdup from the Justice Department.
Well, right. So theoretically, if the government were to win this appeal, it could completely undo the merger or maybe require AT&T to sell off big chunks of the acquired business. But many of the legal experts and Wall Street analysts that Bloomberg quoted believe that the Justice Department is taking a pretty big gamble here, because if they lose this appeal, then they risk setting a more binding legal precedent that would actually make future challenges to this type of merger more difficult. So it definitely sounds like a bit of a long shot on the government's part.
Well, are people at the Justice Department trying to send a message with this? Because after this merger went through, Comcast stepped up its bidding war with Disney over 21st Century Fox. Is this a message to everybody?
Possibly a message, but it's not 100% clear what that message would be. Remember that, you know, Disney is also bidding for those Fox at 21st Century Fox assets too. And their bid was approved by the government rather quickly. And Comcast basically thinks theirs would be permitted too. So regardless of the message, I think, again, it goes back to that legal precedent. That's the real signal that companies are going to react to. If they are successful in this appeal, then, you know, it definitely could prevent some future types of deals.
I want to ask you about one more thing in today's business segment, which is involves Build-A-Bear. This is the company that lets you make a customizable teddy bear in their stores. They had a promotion yesterday called Pay Your Age, so parents with young kids could pay much less to build a bear, which usually starts at between $10 and $50. So here's shopper Jessica Kondratowicz, who told WXYZ-TV in Detroit about the lines that she saw at a mall in Troy, Michigan when she tried to go and build a bear with her kid.
It was wrapped all the way around, all the way, like all the way down the entire length of the mall, and then back to Build-A-Bear.
Mike, some people were waiting for 5 to 7 hours. What went wrong here?
Well, I love this story. Talk about a bear market, am I right?
I
couldn't resist. The company statement was basically, quote, based on the information available to us before the day began, we could not have predicted this type of reaction. So clearly they did not expect it to be this massive reaction that they had. That said, in the long run, I'm not sure having massive crowds show up at your store looking for a discount is the worst news for a company. So I think they'll be okay.
See, Mike and I don't need teddy bears because we both have golden doodles. They're just as cute. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks as always. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, sir.
We know how important diet is to health, and in California, many doctors can now prescribe food as medicine. There are pilot programs in different cities, but the new pilot program in California, launched in May, makes it the first state to allow doctors to prescribe food, in this case, to treat low-income patients with congestive heart failure. They're starting with this group that has some of the highest rates of hospital readmission in California. The program delivers medically tailored meals, plus offers 4 meetings with a registered dietitian to 1,000 patients in 8 counties across California. Sherry Weiser is an associate professor of medicine at UC San Francisco. Professor Weiser, we know your program was inspired by a program in Philadelphia called MANA, or the Metropolitan Area Neighborhood Nutrition Alliance. It also prescribed meals to people undergoing treatment. Tell us more about your pilot study. What might patients with congestive heart failure need that's so specific?
So anyone discharged with congestive heart failure has to adhere to a very strict diet. You know, they have to eat very low sodium, which is a tall order for people even with resources. And on top of that, these are Medi-Cal patients, many who are quite poor and can't really afford to eat healthfully in general. But people who are living on very limited budgets, is very challenging for them to be able to do this in a way that will keep them out of the hospital.
Well, that's the point, because this is kind and it's helpful, but it also keeps them out of the hospital. And this has been proven with other programs. This is about cutting costs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just going into some of the work, you mentioned the pilot studies that form the rationale for this pilot. So the MANA study that you mentioned was one of those. And what they found is that people who received a medically tailored meals, their hospitalizations were reduced by about a half, and inpatient stays were also 37% shorter. And they also found that monthly healthcare costs were about 50% lower among MANA clients receiving the meal intervention compared to those not receiving the meal. I helped spearhead, along with Project Open Hand and my colleague, Dr. Kartika Pillar, another one of the pilots that formed some of the evidence behind this California pilot. And this was a study in San Francisco where we provided people who had either diabetes or HIV with, again, similar 100% of their dietary requirements over a 6-month period, along with nutritional counseling. And in that study, you know, we estimated that it costs about half as much to feed people 100% of their nutritional requirements for 6 months as spending one day in the hospital. So one could have significant cost savings on top of, you know, improvements in their health and quality of life.
But if we extrapolate, if you're finding great results, a three-year program, it'll cost $6 million for these 1,000 people. That's only 1,000 people. And in California, we know, I think, something like a third of the population is covered by Medicaid. Boy, this could become very expensive if you try to help everyone who might need this program.
So that's one way to look at it. But the other way to look at it is the actual healthcare savings that could be incurred. You know, even thinking just about readmissions rates. So the unplanned readmission rate to a hospital after 30 days of discharge can be as high as 15%. So that ends up costing the state millions of dollars for preventable inpatient stays. It's estimated even across the country that as much as $25 billion is spent on preventable readmissions, and that's money that we can save. So one could view that as costly, but the returns on the investment are enormous. When you provide people with healthful food, not only are you helping people with a specific condition like congestive heart failure or diabetes stay healthier, but it's actually helping them address many other comorbidities. It's helping improve their mental health. It's helping prevent them from engaging in risky behaviors, like risky sex to procure food, as an example.
We'll talk about that because, you know, people with terrible food insecurities, women in particular, often do that, trade sex for food.
What's interesting is that this isn't a phenomenon limited to women, because we are finding, actually, in the patients that we interviewed with Project Open Hand and in other populations, that this also is occurring among men. Mm. We had a study, you know, a national study across the U.S. that found that food insecure men had three times the odds of acquiring HIV infection, for instance, because they were engaging in more risky sex. But the phenomenon among women is very key. And I would say internationally, you know, women being disempowered from food insecurity and being forced to engage in risky sexual, you know, either having forced sex or having to make choices like engaging in sex exchange in order to, you know, meet their most basic food requirements is a huge issue. You know, I have a specific story about that, actually. When I got into this whole research area in the first place, I was doing a study with Physicians for Human Rights, and we were trying to understand what was driving the HIV epidemics in Botswana and Swaziland. And so I started interviewing people, and like literally the first woman I interviewed says to me, "Well, we're having sex because we're hungry. If you gave us food, we wouldn't need to have sex to eat." And then I think it was literally my third interview that a woman is like, "Well, what would you do? Here are my choices. I have sex with someone today, get HIV, and will then live 5 to 10 more years, or my children and I starve tomorrow. You know, what would you do?" And no one should be in the position to have to make those kinds of impossible choices.
Well, in the program in California, you are using 6 nonprofits to distribute the free meals to those, you know, again, insured by Medi-Cal, the Medicaid program there, with a specific diet to manage their medical condition. Just to talk a little bit about the preventive side of this, just this notion of a more holistic approach, a preventative approach to health.
Some of the impetus behind the Food as Medicine movement is the fact that it's thought that this will lead to cost savings. But, you know, long before the cost savings are, first of all, that it's a basic human right to have freedom from hunger. So it's the right thing to do no matter what. So the cost savings certainly could help convince people who are not already convinced that this is not going to be costly for the healthcare system because it'll lead to cost saving.
Well, it's going to be costly for big pharma because, you know, if people aren't using as much medication, you're probably going to have pushback.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, one of the most important consequences of food insecurity across many diseases, you know, I've studied this extensively in HIV, is that people who are food insecure don't take their medications. So in some ways, it could be helpful to pharma because really these interventions go hand in hand. If people have access to food, they'll be more likely to take their medications as prescribed.
One last question. Do you think this will become a part of the national Medicaid program? They are watching you.
I mean, we very much hope so. based on all of the data showing that addressing food insecurity can improve health and that it can be cost effective, we strongly anticipate that we'll see health benefits and cost savings. And I think if it is successful, it's very possible that the federal government could determine that medically appropriate food should be a benefit incorporated as part of Medicaid nationally.
Sherry Weiser, Associate Professor of Medicine at UC San Francisco, on California's new pilot program, Treating Food as Medicine, writing prescriptions for it. Sherry, Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today, Iowans are remembering former Governor Robert Ray, who died Sunday at age 89. Ray was a centrist Republican who served five terms as Iowa governor from 1969 to 1983 and was one of the most popular leaders in state history. He was respected for his civility and his compassion. In 1975, Ray volunteered to accept thousands of Southeast Asian refugees fleeing the Vietnam War, despite opposition from many Iowans. Here he is advocating for the refugees.
First of all, these are not communists that we are trying to help. These are people who are fleeing communism. These are people being run out of their homes and are being starved by the communists. And some people have the idea that we're allowing communists to come here. Some people believe that we're taking jobs from others, and that's unfair. And yet we have found that the refugees who have come into our state are basically taking jobs that are going wanting. In other words, others are not taking them. And in some areas, we really need the labor force. And the people that we have taken, for the most part, have been hard workers. And they have been very frugal. They have saved their money. They've made down payments on homes. And they're paying taxes and supporting their families.
Ray also passed the 1979 bottle bill, which offered a nickel refund for soda, beer, and wine bottles and encouraged recycling and reduced litter in Iowa. He often said it was his favorite piece of legislation passed during his time in office. President Trump said today that he apologized to British Prime Minister Theresa May and that he has a lot of respect for her. This after his interview with the UK tabloid The Sun yesterday, that paper, by the way, owned by Rupert Murdoch, the owner of Fox News. Trump's interview was highly critical of Prime Minister May and her approach to Brexit. Here's some of what he told The Sun.
Well, I think the deal that she's striking is not what the people voted on. It's a much different deal than the people voted on. It was not the deal that was in the referendum.
He also praised May's rival, Boris Johnson, who quit as foreign secretary this week in protest of the prime minister's Brexit plan. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Theresa May was asked today how it felt to be criticized by the president in the Sun interview. They were standing right next to each other, and President Trump jumped in before she could answer. Here he is.
Well, maybe I'll go first because I didn't criticize the prime minister. I have a lot of respect for the prime minister. And unfortunately, there was a story that was done, which was, you know, generally fine, but it didn't put in what I said about the prime minister. And I said tremendous things. And fortunately, we tend to record stories now, so we have it for your enjoyment if you'd like it. But we record when we deal with reporters. It's called fake news.
Yeah, we solve a lot. Fake news. He's used that term to describe news organizations he doesn't like. In this case, he's talking about The Sun, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. What do you make of that?
Well, if this had been in Ireland, you would have called it Blarney. In our country, we might call it Bull or something a little sharper. This is something where, you know, he uses the term fake news so grandiosely and so frequently that he's now applying it to what is essentially a pro-Trump tabloid in Britain that is pro-Brexit, which he's very, you know, very much championing the exit from Europe. And he's doing it against a news outlet that is owned by Rupert Murdoch, probably his greatest ally in the American media. It's just his reflexive response. They released the recording and charitably said, you know, for those to accuse the president of really meaning to call us fake news is itself fake news. But they didn't want to criticize the president so concretely because he's such a close ally.
Well, Rupert Murdoch also owns the Times of London and much of the British broadcaster Sky News, possibly more soon. He is very influential in UK politics. For example, Murdoch's papers always supported conservatives, but then changed and supported British Prime Minister Tony Blair's Labour Party in the late 90s over the Conservatives. Blair became Prime Minister. Then Murdoch turned on Blair. He's got a lot of power there.
Yeah, and one of actually the great roots historically of his power and influence both in Britain and his native Australia is that he actually toggled back and forth between sort of center-left parties and more conservative parties on the right. And the uncertainty of people in both parties of knowing whether they could rely on his often punishing, punitive newspapers to rally support behind him or try to take them down meant that they would be very sympathetic to what his interests were and what his policy stances were. It's been a real source of power over the years.
Well, and when you hear Trump say that Boris Johnson would be a great prime minister, I have to wonder whether, you know, he and Rupert Murdoch, who talk all the time, are you know, plotting a new British prime minister. They want to try to, you know, strengthen Johnson and weaken May.
And let's not forget that actually in some ways Murdoch's favored candidate would be Michael Gove, who's been, I believe, the education minister in Theresa May's cabinet and started as a Times of London columnist, that is a paid employee of Rupert Murdoch, somebody Murdoch's championed over the years and who has not had that much of a connection with the British voters. Both Johnson and Gove came out rather intensely in favor of Brexit, which his Sun tabloid really supported strongly. And it was seen at the time, I think then and now, as something that were calculated political moves with the understanding Brexit would never happen. And yet here we are in that country with Brexit having been supported by the voters, as in this country where Murdoch really got behind Donald Trump with Fox News and found, to his surprise, Donald Trump in office.
There was one other moment in the news conference I wanted to ask you about from today. President Trump skipped over a question from a CNN reporter. Here he is.
John Roberts, go ahead, John. No. John Roberts, go ahead. CNN's fake news. I don't take questions. I don't take questions from CNN. CNN is fake news. I don't take questions from CNN. John Roberts of Fox. Let's go to a
real. He said, "There, let's go to a real network." And John Roberts took the, you know, took his opportunity and asked a question. Didn't do what some have said that journalists should do in the past when President Trump does something like this, which is say, no, actually, I'll pass to Jim Acosta of CNN, Mr. President.
Yeah, and I think that was a real crystallization, particularly on Trump's part, of the proximity and comfort, the affirmation that he bathes in over at Fox News. To be fair to John Roberts, he put out a statement today saying basically in defense of an NBC colleague who Trump also essentially attacked, in defense of folks at other news organizations and at CNN, although notably not Jim Acosta. People at Fox will tell you that they think Acosta is a grandstander and will not effectively stand up for him, but Fox, you know, will take pains to point out to other moments at which Fox have helped their colleagues when they've been shut out by the Trump administration. I do think that for many people in the press corps, there's a real skepticism and a lack of credibility felt for Fox because they have effectively, particularly on the opinion side, but also on the news side, served to prop up a presidency that is, in its rhetoric, so antagonist to the media and to the press.
It's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.